spoke in the confident voice to which I was accustomed. "Always a pleasure to see you, ma'am." I watched them through the rearview mirror until Mom opened the trunk. Moments later, Augustus opened a door behind me and engaged in the complicated business of entering the back seat of a car with one leg. "Do you want shotgun?" I asked. "Absolutely not," he said. "And hello, Hazel Grace."
"Hi,"
I said.
"Okay?"
I asked.
"Okay,"
he said.
"Okay," I said.
My mom got in and closed the car door. "Next stop, Amsterdam," she announced. Which was not quite true. The next stop was the airport parking lot, and then a bus took us to the terminal, and then an open-air electric car took us to the security line. The TSA guy at the front of the line was shouting about how our bags had better not contain explosives or firearms or anything liquid over 3 ounces, and I said to Augustus, "Observation, standing in line is a form of oppression." And he said, "Seriously." Rather than be searched by hand, I chose to walk through the metal detector without my cart or my tank, or even the plastic nubbins in my nose. Walking through the X-ray machine marked the first time I'd taken a step without oxygen in some months, and it felt pretty amazing to walk unencumbered like that, stepping across the Rubicon, the machine's silence acknowledging that I was, however briefly, a non-metallicized creature. I felt a bodily sovereignty that I can't really describe, except to say that when I was a kid, I used to have a really heavy backpack that I carried everywhere with all my books in it. And if I walked around with the backpack for long enough, when I took it off, I felt like I was floating. After about 10 seconds, my lungs felt like they were folding in upon themselves like flowers at dusk. I sat down on a gray bench just past the machine and tried to catch my breath, my cough a rattling drizzle. And I felt pretty miserable until I got the cannula back into place. Even then, it hurt. The pain was always there, pulling me inside of myself, demanding to be felt. It always felt like I was waking up from the pain when something in the world outside of me suddenly required my comment or attention. Mom was looking at me, concerned. She'd just said something. What had she just said? Then I remembered. She'd asked what was wrong.
"Nothing,"
I said.
"Amsterdam,"
she half shouted. I smiled.
"Amsterdam,"
I answered. She reached her hand down to me and pulled me up. We got to the gate an hour before our scheduled boarding time.
"Mrs. Lancaster, you are an impressively punctual person," Augustus said as he sat down next to me in the mostly empty gate area.
"Well, it helps that I am not technically very busy," she said.
"You're plenty busy," I told her,
although it occurred to me that Mom's business was mostly me. There was also the business of being married to my dad. He was kind of clueless about, like, banking and hiring plumbers and cooking and doing things other than working for Morris Property, Inc. But it was mostly me. Her primary reason for living and my primary reason for living were awfully entangled. As the seats around the gate started to fill, Augustus said,
"I'm going to get a hamburger before we leave. Can I get you anything?"
"No," I said, "but I really appreciate your refusal to give in to breakfasty social conventions." He tilted his head at me, confused.
"Hazel has developed an issue with the ghettoization of scrambled eggs," Mom said.
"It's embarrassing that we all just walk through life blindly accepting that scrambled eggs are fundamentally associated with mornings."
"I want to talk about this more," Augustus said, "but I am starving. I'll be right back."
When Augustus hadn't showed up after 20 minutes, I asked Mom if she thought something was wrong, and she looked up from her awful magazine only long enough to say, "He probably just went to the bathroom or something." A gate agent came over and switched my oxygen container out with the one provided by the airline. I was embarrassed to have this lady kneeling in front of me while everyone watched, so I texted Augustus while she did it. He didn't reply. Mom seemed unconcerned, but I was imagining all kinds of Amsterdam trip-ruining fates. Arrest, injury, mental breakdown, and I felt like there was something non-cancery wrong with my chest as the minutes ticked away. And just when the lady behind the ticket counter announced that they were going to start pre-boarding people who might need a bit of extra time, and every single person in the gate area turned squarely to me,
I saw Augustus fast limping toward us with a McDonald's bag in one hand, his backpack slung over his shoulder.
"Where were you?" I asked.
"Line got super long, sorry," he said, offering me a hand up.
I took it, and we walked side by side to the gate to pre-board. I could feel everybody watching us, wondering what was wrong with us and whether it would kill us and how heroic my mom must be and everything else.
That was the worst part about having cancer sometimes. The physical evidence of disease separates you from other people.
We were irreconcilably other, and never was it more obvious than when the three of us walked through the empty plane, the stewardess nodding sympathetically and gesturing us toward our row in the distant back. I sat in the middle of our three-person row with Augustus in the window seat and Mom in the aisle. I felt a little hemmed in by Mom, so of course I scooted over toward Augustus. We were right behind the plane's wing. He opened up his bag and unwrapped his burger.
"The thing about eggs, though," he said, "is that breakfastization gives the scrambled egg a certain sacrality, right? You can get yourself some bacon or cheddar cheese anywhere, anytime. From tacos to breakfast sandwiches to grilled cheese, but scrambled eggs, they're important."
"Ludicrous," I said.
The people were starting to file into the plane now. I didn't want to look at them, so I looked away. And to look away was to look at Augustus.
"I'm just saying. Maybe scrambled eggs are ghettoized, but they're also special. They have a place and a time, like church does."
"You couldn't be more wrong," I said. "You are buying into the cross-stitched sentiments of your parents' throw pillows. You're arguing that the fragile, rare thing is beautiful simply because it is fragile and rare, but that's a lie and you know it."
"You're a hard person to comfort."
"Easy comfort isn't comforting," I said. "You were a rare and fragile flower once, you remember." For a moment, he said nothing.
"You do know how to shut me up, Hazel Grace."
"It's my privilege and my responsibility," I answered.
Before I broke eye contact with him, he said,
"Listen, sorry I avoided the gate area. The McDonald's line wasn't really that long. I just didn't want to sit there with all those people looking at us or whatever."
"At me, mostly," I said. "You could glance at Gus and never know he'd been sick. But I carried my disease with me on the outside, which is part of why I'd become a homebody in the first place."
Augustus Waters, noted charismatist, is embarrassed to sit next to a girl with an oxygen tank.
"Not embarrassed," he said. "They just piss me off sometimes, and I don't want to be pissed off today."
After a minute, he dug into his pocket and flipped open his pack of smokes. About 9 seconds later, a blonde stewardess rushed over to our row and said,
"Sir, you can't smoke on this plane, or any plane."
"I don't smoke," he explained, the cigarette dancing in his mouth as he spoke.
"But it's a metaphor," I explained.
"He puts the killing thing in his mouth but doesn't give it the power to kill him." The stewardess was flummoxed for only a moment.
"Well, that metaphor is prohibited on today's flight," she said.
Gus nodded and rejoined the cigarette to its pack. We finally taxied out to the runway and the pilot said, "Flight attendants, prepare for departure." And then two tremendous jet engines roared to life and we began to accelerate.
"This is what it feels like to drive in a car with you," I said.
And he smiled, but kept his jaw clenched tight, and I said,
"Okay?"
We were picking up speed and suddenly Gus's hand grabbed the armrest, his eyes wide, and I put my hand on top of his and said,
"Okay?"
He didn't say anything, just stared at me wide-eyed, and I said,
"Are you scared of flying?"
"I'll tell you in a minute," he said.
The nose of the plane rose up and we were aloft. Gus stared out the window, watching the planet shrink beneath us, and then I felt his hand relax beneath mine. He glanced at me and then back out the window.
"We are flying," he announced.
"You've never been on a plane before?"
He shook his head.
"Look,"
he half shouted, pointing at the window.
"Yeah,"
I said. "Yeah, I see it. It looks like we're in an airplane."
"Nothing has ever looked like that ever in all of human history," he said.
His enthusiasm was adorable. I couldn't resist leaning over to kiss him on the cheek.
"Just so you know, I'm right here," Mom said. "Sitting next to you, your mother."
who held your hand as you took your first infantile steps.
It's friendly,
I reminded her, turning to kiss her on the cheek.
Didn't feel too friendly, Gus mumbled just loud enough for me to hear.
When surprised and excited and innocent Gus emerged from grand gesture metaphorically inclined Augustus, I literally could not resist. It was a quick flight to Detroit, where the little electric car met us as we disembarked and drove us to the gate for Amsterdam. That plane had TVs in the back of each seat, and once we were above the clouds, Augustus and I timed it so that we started watching the same romantic comedy at the same time on our respective screens. But even though we were perfectly synchronized in our pressing of the play button, his movie started a couple seconds before mine, so at every funny moment, he'd laugh just as I started to hear whatever the joke was. Mom had this big plan that we would sleep for the last several hours of the flight, so when we landed at 8 a.m., we'd hit the city ready to suck the marrow out of life or whatever. So after the movie was over, Mom and Augustus and I all took sleeping pills. Mom conked out within seconds, but Augustus and I stayed up to look out the window for a while. It was a clear day, and although we couldn't see the sun setting, we could see the sky's response.
God, that is beautiful, I said mostly to myself.
The risen sun too bright in her losing eyes, he said, a line from An Imperial Affliction. But it's not rising, I said.
It's rising somewhere, he answered, and then after a moment said, Observation. It would be awesome to fly in a superfast airplane that could chase the sunrise around the world for a while.
Also, I'd live longer.
He looked at me askew. You know, because of relativity or whatever. He still looked confused.
We age slower when we move quickly versus standing still, so right now time is passing slower for us than for people on the ground.
College chicks, he said. They're so smart.
I rolled my eyes. He hit his real knee with my knee, and I hit his knee back with mine.
Are you sleepy? I asked him.
Not at all, he answered.
Yeah, I said. Me neither. Sleeping meds and narcotics didn't do for me what they did for normal people.
Want to watch another movie? He asked. They've got a Portman movie from her Hazel era.
I want to watch something you haven't seen.
In the end, we watched 300, a war movie about 300 Spartans who protect Sparta from an invading army of like a billion Persians. Augustus's movie started before mine again, and after a few minutes of hearing him go, dang, or fatality, every time someone was killed in some badass way, I leaned over the armrest and put my head on his shoulder so I could see his screen and we could actually watch the movie together. 300 featured a sizable collection of shirtless and well-oiled strapping young lads, so it was not particularly difficult on the eyes, but it was mostly a lot of sword-wielding to no real effect. The bodies of the Persians and the Spartans piled up, and I couldn't quite figure out why the Persians were so evil or the Spartans so awesome. Contemporaneity, to quote AIA, specializes in the kind of battles wherein no one loses anything of any value, except arguably their lives. And so it was with these titans clashing. Toward the end of the movie, almost everyone is dead. And there is this insane moment when the Spartans start stacking the bodies of the dead up to form a wall of corpses. The dead become this massive roadblock standing between the Persians and the road to Sparta. I found the gore a bit gratuitous, so I looked away for a second, asking Augustus,
"How many dead people do you think there are?"
He dismissed me with a wave.
"Shh, shh, this is getting awesome."
When the Persians attacked, they had to climb up the wall of death, and the Spartans were able to occupy the high ground atop the corpse mountain, and as the bodies piled up, the wall of martyrs only became higher and therefore harder to climb, and everybody swung swords or shot arrows, and the rivers of blood poured down Mount Death, etc. I took my head off his shoulder for a moment to get a break from the gore and watched Augustus watch the movie. He couldn't contain his goofy grin. I watched my own screen through squinted eyes as the mountain grew with the bodies of Persians and Spartans. When the Persians finally overran the Spartans, I looked over at Augustus again. Even though the good guys had just lost, Augustus seemed downright joyful. I nuzzled up to him again, but kept my eyes closed until the battle was finished. As the credits rolled, he took off his headphones and said, "Sorry. I was awash in the nobility of sacrifice. What were you saying?"
"How many dead people do you think there are?"
"Like, how many fictional people died in that fictional movie?" "Not enough," he joked.
"No, I mean, like, ever. Like, how many people do you think have ever died?"
"I happen to know the answer to that question," he said. "There are 7 billion living people and about 98 billion dead people."
"Oh," I said. I'd thought that maybe since population growth had been so fast, there were more people alive than all the dead combined.
"There are about 14 dead people for every living person," he said.
The credits continued rolling. It took a long time to identify all those corpses, I guess. My head was still on his shoulder. "I did some research on this a couple of years ago," Augustus continued. "I was wondering if everybody could be remembered. Like, if we got organized and assigned a certain number of corpses to each living person, would there be enough living people to remember all the dead people?"
"And there are?" "Sure. Anyone can name 14 dead people."
"But we're disorganized mourners, so a lot of people end up remembering Shakespeare, and no one ends up remembering the person he wrote Sonnet 55 about."
"Yeah," I said.
It was quiet for a minute, and then he asked, "Do you want to read or something?" I said, "Sure." I was reading this long poem called Howl by Allen Ginsberg for my poetry class, and Gus was rereading An Imperial Affliction. After a while, he said, "Is it any good?"
"The poem?" I asked.
"Yeah."
"Yeah, it's great. The guys in this poem take even more drugs than I do. How's AIA?"
"Still perfect," he said. "Read to me."
This isn't really a poem to read aloud when you are sitting next to your sleeping mother. It has, like, sodomy and angel dust in it, I said.
"You just named two of my favorite pastimes," he said.
"Okay, read me something else then."
I said, "I don't have anything else."
"That's too bad. I am so in the mood for poetry. Do you have anything memorized?"
"Let us go then, you and I," I started nervously. "When the evening is spread out against the sky, like a patient etherized upon a table."
"Slower," he said.
I felt bashful, like I had when I'd first told him of An Imperial Affliction.
Okay. Okay.
"Let us go. Through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights in one-night cheap hotels, and sawdust restaurants with oyster shells, streets that follow like a tedious argument of insidious intent, to lead you to an overwhelming question. Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit."
"I'm in love with you," he said quietly.
"Augustus," I said.
"I am," he said.
He was staring at me, and I could see the corners of his eyes crinkling.
"I'm in love with you, and I'm not in the business of denying myself the simple pleasure of saying true things. I'm in love with you, and I know that love is just a shout into the void, and that oblivion is inevitable, and that we're all doomed, and that there will come a day when all our labor has been returned to dust, and I know the sun will swallow the only earth we'll ever have, and I am in love with you."
"Augustus," I said again, not knowing what else to say. It felt like everything was rising up in me, like I was drowning in this weirdly painful joy, but I couldn't say it back. I couldn't say anything back. I just looked at him and let him look at me until he nodded, lips pursed, and turned away, placing the side of his head against the window. Chapter 11. I think he must have fallen asleep. I did, eventually, and woke to the landing gear coming down. My mouth tasted horrible, and I tried to keep it shut for fear of poisoning the airplane. I looked over at Augustus, who was staring out the window, and as we dipped below the low-hung clouds, I straightened my back to see the Netherlands. The land seemed sunk into the ocean, little rectangles of green surrounded on all sides by canals. We landed, in fact, parallel to a canal, like there were two runways, one for us and one for waterfowl.
After getting our bags and clearing customs, we all piled into a taxi driven by this doughy bald guy who spoke perfect English, like better English than I do.
"The Hotel Philosophe?" I said.
And he said, "You are Americans?"
"Yes," Mom said. "We're from Indiana."
"Indiana," he said. "They steal the land from the Indians and leave the name, yes?"
"Something like that," Mom said. The cabbie pulled out into traffic and we headed toward a highway with lots of blue signs featuring double vowels.
Oosthuizen, Harlem.
Beside the highway, flat empty land stretched for miles, interrupted by the occasional huge corporate headquarters. In short, Holland looked like Indianapolis, only with smaller cars.
"This is Amsterdam?" I asked the cab driver.
"Yes and no," he answered. "Amsterdam is like the rings of a tree. It gets older as you get closer to the center."
It happened all at once. We exited the highway and there were the row houses of my imagination, leaning precariously toward canals, ubiquitous bicycles, and coffee shops advertising large smoking room. We drove over a canal and from atop the bridge I could see dozens of houseboats moored along the water. It looked nothing like America. It looked like an old painting, but real. Everything achingly idyllic in the morning light. And I thought about how wonderfully strange it would be to live in a place where almost everything had been built by the dead.
"Are these houses very old?" asked my mom.
"Many of the canal houses date from the Golden Age, the 17th century," he said. "Our city has a rich history, even though many tourists are only wanting to see the red light district."
He paused.
"Some tourists think Amsterdam is a city of sin. But in truth, it is a city of freedom. And in freedom, most people find sin."
All the rooms in the Hotel Philosophe were named after philosophers. Mom and I were staying on the ground floor in the Kierkegaard. Augustus was on the floor above us, in the Heidegger. Our room was small. A double bed pressed against a wall with my BiPAP machine, an oxygen concentrator, and a dozen refillable oxygen tanks at the foot of the bed. Past the equipment, there was a dusty old paisley chair with a sagging seat, a desk, and a bookshelf above the bed containing the collected works of Søren Kierkegaard. On the desk we found a wicker basket full of presents from the genies. Wooden shoes, an orange Holland t-shirt, chocolates, and various other goodies. The Philosophe was right next to the Vondelpark, Amsterdam's most famous park. Mom wanted to go on a walk, but I was super tired, so she got the BiPAP working and placed its snout on me. I hated talking with that thing on, but I said, "Just go to the park, and I'll call you when I wake up."
"Okay," she said. "Sleep tight, honey."
But when I woke some hours later, she was sitting in the ancient little chair in the corner, reading a guidebook.
"Morning," I said.
"Actually, late afternoon," she answered, pushing herself out of the chair with a sigh.
She came to the bed, placed a tank in the cart, and connected it to the tube while I took off the BiPAP snout and placed the nubbins into my nose. She set it for 2.5 liters a minute, 6 hours before I'd need a change, and then I got up.
"How are you feeling?" she asked.
"Good," I said.
"Great. How was the Vondelpark?"
"I skipped it," she said. "Read all about it in the guidebook, though."
"Mom," I said, "you didn't have to stay here." She shrugged.
"I know. I wanted to.
I like watching you sleep," said the creeper.
She laughed, but I still felt bad.
"I just want you to have fun or whatever, you know?"
"Okay. I'll have fun tonight, okay? I'll go do crazy mom stuff while you and Augustus go to dinner."
"Without you?" I asked.
"Yes, without me.
In fact, you have reservations at a place called Orange," she said. "Mr. Van Houten's assistant set it up. It's in this neighborhood called the Jordaan. Very fancy, according to the guidebook. There's a tram station right around the corner. Augustus has directions. You can eat outside, watch the boats go by. It'll be lovely."
"Very romantic."
"Mom, I'm just saying," she said. "You should get dressed. The sundress, maybe?
One might marvel at the insanity of the situation. A mother sends her 16-year-old daughter alone with a 17-year-old boy out into a foreign city famous for its permissiveness. But this, too, was a side effect of dying. I could not run or dance or eat foods rich in nitrogen, but in the City of Freedom, I was among the most liberated of its residents. I did indeed wear the sundress, this blueprint, flowy, knee-length Forever 21 thing, with tights and Mary Janes because I liked being quite a lot shorter than him. I went into the hilariously tiny bathroom and battled my bedhead for a while until everything looked suitably mid-2000s Natalie Portman. At 6 p.m. on the dot, noon back home, there was a knock. "Hello?" I said through the door. There was no peephole at the Hotel Philosophe.
"Okay,"
Augustus answered. I could hear the cigarette in his mouth. I looked down at myself. The sundress offered the most in the way of my ribcage and collarbone that Augustus had seen. It wasn't obscene or anything, but it was as close as I ever got to showing some skin. My mother had a motto on this front that I agreed with. Lancasters don't bear midriffs. I pulled the door open. Augustus wore a black suit, narrow lapels, perfectly tailored, over a light blue dress shirt and a thin black tie. A cigarette dangled from the unsmiling corner of his mouth.
"Hazel Grace," he said. "You look gorgeous."
I said. I kept thinking the rest of my sentence would emerge from the air passing through my vocal cords, but nothing happened. Then finally I said, "I feel underdressed."
"Ah, this old thing,"
he said, smiling down at me. "Augustus," my mom said behind me. "You look extremely handsome."
"Thank you, ma'am," he said.
He offered me his arm. I took it, glancing back to mom. "See you by 11," she said. Waiting for the number one tram on a wide street busy with traffic, I said to Augustus, "The suit you wear to funerals, I assume?"
"Actually, no," he said. "That suit isn't nearly this nice."
The blue and white tram arrived, and Augustus handed our cards to the driver, who explained that we needed to wave them at this circular sensor. As we walked through the crowded tram, an old man stood up to give us seats together, and I tried to tell him to sit, but he gestured toward the seat insistently. We rode the tram for 3 stops, me leaning over Gus so we could look out the window together. Augustus pointed up at the trees and asked, "Do you see that?" I did. There were elm trees everywhere along the canals, and these seeds were blowing out of them. But they didn't look like seeds. They looked for all the world like miniaturized rose petals drained of their color. These pale petals were gathering in the wind like flocking birds, thousands of them, like a spring snowstorm. The old man who'd given up his seat saw us noticing and said, in English, "Amsterdam's spring snow. The hippin throw confetti to greet the spring." We switched trams, and after 4 stops we arrived at a street split by a beautiful canal, the reflections of the ancient bridge and picturesque canal houses rippling in water. Orange was just steps from the tram. The restaurant was on one side of the street, the outdoor seating on the other, on a concrete outcropping right at the edge of the canal. The hostess's eyes lit up as Augustus and I walked toward her.
"Mr. and Mrs. Waters?"
"I guess," I said.
"Your table,"
she said, gesturing across the street to a narrow table inches from the canal.
"The champagne is our gift."
Gus and I glanced at each other, smiling. Once we'd crossed the street, he pulled out a seat for me and helped me scoot it back in. There were indeed 2 flutes of champagne at our white tablecloth table. The slight chill in the air was balanced magnificently by the sunshine. On one side of us, cyclists pedaled past, well-dressed men and women on their way home from work, improbably attractive blonde girls riding side-saddle on the back of a friend's bike, tiny, helmetless kids bouncing around in plastic seats behind their parents. And on our other side, the canal water was choked with millions of the confetti seeds. Little boats were moored at the brick banks, half full of rainwater, some of them near sinking. A bit farther down the canal, I could see houseboats floating on pontoons. And in the middle of the canal, an open-air, flat-bottomed boat decked out with lawn chairs and a portable stereo idled toward us. Augustus took his flute of champagne and raised it. I took mine, even though I'd never had a drink aside from sips of my dad's beer.
Okay, he said.
Okay, I said, and we clinked glasses. I took a sip. The tiny bubbles melted in my mouth and journeyed northward into my brain. Sweet, crisp, delicious. That is really good, I said. I've never drunk champagne.
A sturdy young waiter with wavy blonde hair appeared. He was maybe even taller than Augustus.
Do you know, he asked in a delicious accent, what Dom Perignon said after inventing champagne?
No, I said.
He called out to his fellow monks, come quickly, I am tasting the stars.
Welcome to Amsterdam. Would you like to see a menu, or will you have the chef's choice?
I looked at Augustus and he at me. The chef's choice sounds lovely, but Hazel is a vegetarian. I'd mentioned this to Augustus precisely once on the first day we met.
This is not a problem, the waiter said.
Awesome. And can we get more of this? Gus asked of the champagne.
Of course, said our waiter. We have bottled all the stars this evening, my young friends.
Gah, the confetti, he said, and lightly brushed a seed from my bare shoulder.
It hasn't been so bad in many years. It's everywhere. Very annoying.
The waiter disappeared. We watched the confetti fall from the sky, skip across the ground in the breeze, and tumble into the canal.
Kind of hard to believe anyone could ever find that annoying, Augustus said after a while.
People always get used to beauty, though.
I haven't gotten used to you just yet, he answered, smiling.
I felt myself blushing.
Thank you for coming to Amsterdam, he said.
Thank you for letting me hijack your wish, I said.
Thank you for wearing that dress, which is like, whoa, he said.
I shook my head, trying not to smile at him. I didn't want to be a grenade. But then again, he knew what he was doing, didn't he? It was his choice, too.
Hey, how's that poem end? He asked.
Huh?
The one you recited to me on the plane.
Oh, Prufrock? It ends, we have lingered in the chambers of the sea, by sea girls wreathed with seaweed red and brown, till human voices wake us, and we drown.
Augustus pulled out a cigarette and tapped the filter against the table. Stupid human voice is always ruining everything.
The waiter arrived with two more glasses of champagne and what he called Belgian white asparagus with lavender infusion.
I've never had champagne either, Gus said after he left. In case you were wondering or whatever. Also, I've never had white asparagus.
I was chewing my first bite.
It's amazing, I promised.
He took a bite, swallowed.
God, if asparagus tasted like that all the time, I'd be a vegetarian too.
Some people in a lacquered wooden boat approached us on the canal below. One of them, a woman with curly blonde hair, maybe 30, drank from a beer, then raised her glass toward us and shouted something.
We don't speak Dutch!
Gus shouted back. One of the others shouted a translation.
The beautiful couple is beautiful!
The food was so good that with each passing course, our conversation devolved further into fragmented celebrations of its deliciousness. I want this dragon carrot risotto to become a person so I can take it to Las Vegas and marry it.
Sweet pea sorbet, you are so unexpectedly magnificent.
I wish I'd been hungrier. After green garlic gnocchi with red mustard leaves, the waiter said,
Dessert next. More stars first.
I shook my head. Two glasses was enough for me. Champagne was no exception to my high tolerance for depressants and pain relievers. I felt warm, but not intoxicated. But I didn't want to get drunk. Nights like this one didn't come along often, and I wanted to remember it. I said after the waiter left. And Augustus smiled crookedly as he stared down the canal while I stared up it.
We had plenty to look at, so the silence didn't feel awkward, really. But I wanted everything to be perfect. It was perfect, I guess. But it felt like someone had tried to stage the Amsterdam of my imagination, which made it hard to forget that this dinner, like the trip itself, was a cancer perk. I just wanted us to be talking and joking comfortably, like we were on the couch together back home, but some tension underlay everything.
"It's not my funeral suit," he said after a while. "When I first found out I was sick, I mean, they told me I had like an 85% chance of cure. I know those are great odds, but I kept thinking it was a game of Russian roulette. I mean, I was going to have to go through hell for 6 months or a year and lose my leg, and then at the end, it still might not work, you know?"
"I know," I said, although I didn't, not really. I'd never been anything but terminal. All my treatment had been in pursuit of extending my life, not curing my cancer. Phalanxophor had introduced a measure of ambiguity to my cancer story, but I was different from Augustus. My final chapter was written upon diagnosis. Gus, like most cancer survivors, lived with uncertainty.
"Right," he said. "So I went through this whole thing about wanting to be ready. We bought a plot in Crown Hill, and I walked around with my dad one day and picked out a spot. And I had my whole funeral planned out and everything, and then right before surgery, I asked my parents if I could buy a suit, like a really nice suit, just in case I bit it. Anyway, I've never had occasion to wear it. Until tonight."
"So it's your death suit?"
"Correct. Don't you have a death outfit?"
"Yeah," I said. "It's a dress I bought for my 15th birthday party, but I don't wear it on dates."
His eyes lit up. "We're on a date?" he asked.
I looked down, feeling bashful. "Don't push it." We were both really full, but dessert, a succulently rich crémeux surrounded by passion fruit, was too good not to at least nibble, so we lingered for a while over dessert, trying to get hungry again. The sun was a toddler, insistently refusing to go to bed. It was past 8:30 and still light. Out of nowhere, Augustus asked, "Do you believe in an afterlife?"
"I think forever is an incorrect concept," I answered.
He smirked. "You're an incorrect concept."
"I know. That's why I'm being taken out of the rotation."
"That's not funny," he said, looking at the street. Two girls passed on a bike, one riding side saddle over the back wheel.
"Come on," I said. "That was a joke."
"The thought of you being removed from the rotation is not funny to me," he said. "Seriously, though, afterlife?"
"No," I said, and then revised. "Well, maybe I wouldn't go so far as no. You?"
"Yes," he said, his voice full of confidence. "Yes, absolutely. Not like a heaven where you ride unicorns, play harps, and live in a mansion made of clouds, but yes. I believe in something with a capital S. Always have."
"Really?"
I asked.
I was surprised. I'd always associated belief in heaven with, frankly, a kind of intellectual disengagement. But Gus wasn't dumb.
"Yeah," he said quietly. "I believe in that line from An Imperial Affliction. The risen sun too bright in her losing eyes. That's God, I think, the rising sun. And the light is too bright and her eyes are losing, but they aren't lost. I don't believe we return to haunt or comfort the living or anything, but I think something becomes of us."
"But you fear oblivion."
"Sure, I fear earthly oblivion. But I mean, not to sound like my parents, but I believe humans have souls. And I believe in the conservation of souls. The oblivion fear is something else, fear that I won't be able to give anything in exchange for my life. If you don't live a life in service of a greater good, you've got to at least die a death in service of a greater good, you know? And I fear that I won't get either a life or a death that means anything."
I just shook my head.
"What?"
he asked. "Your obsession with, like, dying for something or leaving behind some great sign of your heroism or whatever. It's just weird."
"Everyone wants to lead an extraordinary life."
"Not everyone," I said, unable to disguise my annoyance.
"Are you mad?"
"It's just," I said, and then couldn't finish my sentence. "Just," I said again. Between us flickered the candle. "It's really mean of you to say that the only lives that matter are the ones that are lived for something or die for something. That's a really mean thing to say to me."
I felt like a little kid for some reason, and I took a bite of dessert to make it appear like it was not that big of a deal to me.
Sorry, he said. I didn't mean it like that. I was just thinking about myself.
Yeah, you were, I said. I was too full to finish. I worried I might puke, actually, because I often puked after eating. Not bulimia, just cancer. I pushed my dessert plate toward Gus, but he shook his head.
I'm sorry, he said again, reaching across the table for my hand.
I let him take it.
I could be worse, you know.
How? I asked, teasing.
I mean, I have a work of calligraphy over my toilet that reads, "Bathe yourself daily in the comfort of God's words, Hazel." I could be way worse.
Sounds unsanitary, I said.
I could be worse.
You could be worse, I smiled. He really did like me. Maybe I was a narcissist or something, but when I realized it there in that moment at Orange, it made me like him even more. When our waiter appeared to take dessert away, he said,
"Your meal has been paid for by Mr. Peter Van Houten."
Augustus smiled.
"This Peter Van Houten fellow ain't half bad."
We walked along the canal as it got dark. A block up from Orange, we stopped at a park bench surrounded by old rusty bicycles locked to bike racks and to each other. We sat down hip to hip facing the canal, and he put his arm around me. I could see the halo of light coming from the red light district. Even though it was the red light district, the glow coming from up there was an eerie sort of green. I imagined thousands of tourists getting drunk and stoned and pinballing around the narrow streets.
I can't believe he's going to tell us tomorrow, I said.
Peter Van Houten is going to tell us the famously unwritten end of the best book ever.
Plus he paid for our dinner, Augustus said.
I keep imagining that he is going to search us for recording devices before he tells us, and then he will sit down between us on the couch in his living room and whisper whether Anna's mom married the Dutch tulip man.
Don't forget Sisyphus the hamster, Augustus added.
Right, and also, of course, what fate awaited Sisyphus the hamster. I leaned forward to see into the canal. There were so many of those pale elm petals in the canals, it was ridiculous. A sequel that will exist just for us, I said.
So what's your guess? He asked.
I really don't know. I've gone back and forth like 1,000 times about it all. Each time I reread it, I think something different, you know? He nodded. You have a theory?
Yeah. I don't think the Dutch tulip man is a con man, but he's also not ripped like he leads them to believe. And I think, after Anna dies, Anna's mom goes to Holland with him and thinks they will live there forever, but it doesn't work out because she wants to be near where her daughter was.
I hadn't realized he'd thought about the books so much, that an imperial affliction mattered to Gus independently of me mattering to him. The water lapped quietly at the stone canal walls beneath us. A group of friends biked past in a clump, shouting over each other in rapid-fire, guttural Dutch. The tiny boats, not much longer than me, half-drowned in the canal. The smell of water that had stood too still for too long. His arm pulling me in. His real leg against my real leg, all the way from hip to foot. I leaned into his body a little. He winced.
Sorry, you okay?
He breathed out a, yeah, in obvious pain.
Sorry,
I said. Bony shoulder.
It's okay, he said. Nice, actually.
We sat there for a long time. Eventually, his hand abandoned my shoulder and rested against the back of the park bench. Mostly, we just stared into the canal. I was thinking a lot about how they'd made this place exist even though it should have been underwater, and how I was, for Dr. Maria, a kind of Amsterdam, a half-drowned anomaly. And that made me think about dying. Can I ask you about Caroline Mathers?
And you say there's no afterlife, he answered without looking at me.
But yeah, of course. What do you want to know? I wanted to know that he would be okay if I died. I wanted to not be a grenade, to not be a malevolent force in the lives of people I loved. Just like what happened. He sighed, exhaling for so long that to my crap lungs it seemed like he was bragging. He popped a fresh cigarette into his mouth.
You know how there is famously no place less played in than a hospital playground?
I nodded.
Well, I was at Memorial for a couple weeks when they took off the leg and everything. I was up on the fifth floor, and I had a view of the playground, which was always, of course, utterly desolate. I was all awash in the metaphorical resonance of the empty playground in the hospital courtyard. But then this girl started showing up alone at the playground every day, swinging on a swing, completely alone, like you'd see in a movie or something. So I asked one of my nicer nurses to get the skinny on the girl, and the nurse brought her up to visit, and it was Caroline. And I used my immense charisma to win her over. He paused, so I decided to say something.
You're not that charismatic, I said.
He scoffed, disbelieving.
You're mostly just hot, I explained.
He laughed it off. The thing about dead people, he said, and then stopped himself. The thing is, you sound like a bastard if you don't romanticize them, but the truth is complicated, I guess. Like, you are familiar with the trope of the stoic and determined cancer victim who heroically fights her cancer with inhuman strength and never complains or stops smiling, even at the very end, etc.
Indeed, I said. They are kind-hearted and generous souls whose every breath is an inspiration to us all. They're so strong. We admire them so.
Right, but really? I mean, aside from us, obviously. Cancer kids are not statistically more likely to be awesome or compassionate or perseverant or whatever. Caroline was always moody and miserable, but I liked it. I liked feeling as if she had chosen me as the only person in the world not to hate. And so we spent all this time together just ragging on everyone, you know? Ragging on the nurses and the other kids and our families and whatever else. But I don't know if that was her or the tumor. I mean, one of her nurses told me once that the kind of tumor Caroline had is known among medical types as the asshole tumor, because it just turns you into a monster. So here's this girl missing a fifth of her brain who's just had a recurrence of the asshole tumor, and so she was not, you know, the paragon of stoic cancer kid heroism. She was, I mean, to be honest, she was a bitch. But you can't say that, because she had this tumor, and also she's dead. And she had plenty of reason to be unpleasant, you know?
I knew.
You know that part in An Imperial Affliction when Anna's walking across the football field to go to PE or whatever, and she falls and goes face first into the grass, and that's when she knows that the cancer is back, and in her nervous system. And she can't get up, and her face is like an inch from the football field grass, and she's just stuck there, looking at this grass up close, noticing the way the light hits it, and I don't remember the line, but it's something like Anna having the Whitman-esque revelation that the definition of humanness is the opportunity to marvel at the majesty of creation or whatever. You know that part?
I know that part, I said.
So afterward, while I was getting eviscerated by chemo, for some reason I decided to feel really hopeful. Not about survival specifically, but I felt like Anna does in the book, that feeling of excitement and gratitude about just being able to marvel at it all. But meanwhile, Caroline got worse every day. She went home after a while, and there were moments when I thought we could have, like, a regular relationship, but we couldn't, really, because she had no filter between her thoughts and her speech, which was sad and unpleasant and frequently hurtful. But, I mean, you can't dump a girl with a brain tumor. And her parents liked me, and she has this little brother who's a really cool kid. I mean, how can you dump her? She's dying. It took forever. It took almost a year. And it was a year of me hanging out with this girl who would, like, just start laughing out of nowhere and point at my prosthetic and call me Stumpy.
No,
I said. Yeah. I mean, it was the tumor. It ate her brain, you know? Or it wasn't the tumor. I have no way of knowing, because they were inseparable, she and the tumor. But as she got sicker, I mean, she'd just repeat the same stories and laugh at her own comments, even if she'd already said the same thing 100 times that day. Like, she made the same joke over and over again for weeks. Gus has great legs, I mean leg. And then she would just laugh like a maniac.
Oh, Gus, I said. That's...
I didn't know what to say. He wasn't looking at me, and it felt invasive of me to look at him. I felt him scoot forward. He took the cigarette out of his mouth and stared at it, rolling it between his thumb and forefinger, then put it back. Well, he said, to be fair, I do have great leg.
I'm sorry, I said. I'm really sorry.
It's all good, Hazel Grace. But just to be clear,
When I thought I saw Caroline Mather's ghost in support group, I was not entirely happy. I was staring, but I wasn't yearning, if you know what I mean.
He pulled the pack out of his pocket and placed the cigarette back in it. I'm sorry, I said again.
Me too, he said.
I don't ever want to do that to you, I told him.
Oh, I wouldn't mind, Hazel Grace. It would be a privilege to have my heart broken by you.
Chapter 12. I woke up at 4 in the Dutch morning, ready for the day. All attempts to go back to sleep failed, so I lay there with the BiPAP pumping the air in and urging it out, enjoying the dragon sounds but wishing I could choose my breaths. I reread An Imperial Affliction until Mom woke up and rolled over toward me around 6. She nuzzled her head against my shoulder, which felt uncomfortable and vaguely Augustinian. The hotel brought a breakfast to our room that, much to my delight, featured deli meat among many other denials of American breakfast constructions. The dress I'd planned to wear to meet Peter Van Houten had been moved up in the rotation for the orange dinner, so after I showered and got my hair to lie halfway flat, I spent like 30 minutes debating with Mom the various benefits and drawbacks of the available outfits before deciding to dress as much like Anna in AIA as possible. Chuck Taylors and dark jeans like she always wore, and a light blue t-shirt. The shirt was a screen print of a famous surrealist artwork by René Magritte, in which he drew a pipe and then beneath it wrote in cursive, "Ceci n'est pas une pipe." This is not a pipe.
I just don't get that shirt, Mom said.
Peter Van Houten will get it, trust me. There are like 7,000 Magritte references in An Imperial Affliction.
But it is a pipe.
No, it's not, I said. It's a drawing of a pipe. Get it? All representations of a thing are inherently abstract. It's very clever.
How did you get so grown up that you understand things that confuse your ancient mother? Mom asked. It seems like just yesterday that I was telling 7-year-old Hazel why the sky was blue. You thought I was a genius back then.
Why is the sky blue? I asked.
'Cause, she answered. I laughed. As it got closer to 10, I grew more and more nervous. Nervous to see Augustus. Nervous to meet Peter Van Houten. Nervous that my outfit was not a good outfit. Nervous that we wouldn't find the right house since all the houses in Amsterdam looked pretty similar. Nervous that we would get lost and never make it back to the Philosoph. Nervous, nervous, nervous. Mom kept trying to talk to me, but I couldn't really listen. I was about to ask her to go upstairs and make sure Augustus was up when he knocked. I opened the door. He looked down at the shirt and smiled.
Funny, he said.
Don't call my boobs funny, I answered.
Right here, Mom said behind us.
But I'd made Augustus blush and put him enough off his game that I could finally bear to look up at him.
You sure you don't want to come? I asked Mom.
I'm going to the Rijksmuseum and the Vondelpark today, she said. Plus, I just don't get his book.
No offense.
Thank him and Litwidge for us, okay?
Okay, I said.
I hugged Mom, and she kissed my head just above my ear. Peter Van Houten's white row house was just around the corner from the hotel, on the Vondelstraat, facing the park. Number 158. Augustus took me by one arm and grabbed the oxygen cart with the other, and we walked up the 3 steps to the lacquered blue-black front door. My heart pounded. One closed door away from the answers I'd dreamed of ever since I first read that last unfinished page. Inside, I could hear a bass beat thumping loud enough to rattle the windowsills. I wondered whether Peter Van Houten had a kid who liked rap music. I grabbed the lion's head door knocker and knocked tentatively. The beat continued.
"Maybe he can't hear over the music?" Augustus asked.
He grabbed the lion's head and knocked much louder. The music disappeared, replaced by shuffled footsteps. A deadbolt slid. Another. The door creaked open. A pot-bellied man with thin hair, sagging jowls, and a week-old beard squinted into the sunlight. He wore baby blue man pajamas like guys in old movies. His face and belly were so round, and his arms so skinny, that he looked like a dough ball with 4 sticks stuck into it.
"Mr. Van Houten?" Augustus asked, his voice squeaking a bit.
The door slammed shut. Behind it, I heard a stammering, reedy voice shout,
Lidovai!
Until then, I'd pronounced his assistant's name like Lidowich. We could hear everything through the door.
Are they here, Peter?
A woman asked.
There are... Lidovai, there are two adolescent apparitions outside the door.
Apparitions? She asked with a pleasant Dutch lilt. Van Houten answered in a rush.
Phantasms, specters, ghouls, visitants, post-terrestrials, apparitions, Lidovai. How can someone pursuing a postgraduate degree in American literature display such abominable English language skills?
Peter, those are not post-terrestrials. They are Augustus and Hazel, the young fans with whom you have been corresponding.
They are... What? They... I thought they were in America.
Yes, but you invited them here, you will remember.
Do you know why I left America, Lidovai? So that I would never again have to encounter Americans.
But you are an American.
Incurably so, it seems. But as to these Americans, you must tell them to leave at once, that there has been a terrible mistake. That the blessed Van Houten was making a rhetorical offer to meet, not an actual one, that such offers must be read symbolically.
I thought I might throw up. I looked over at Augustus, who was staring intently at the door, and saw his shoulders slacken.
I will not do this, Peter, answered Lidovai. You must meet them. You must. You need to see them. You need to see how your work matters. Lidovai, did you knowingly deceive me to arrange this?
A long silence ensued. And then, finally, the door opened again. He turned his head metronomically from Augustus to me, still squinting.
Which of you is Augustus Waters? He asked.
Augustus raised his hand tentatively.
Van Houten nodded and said, Did you close the deal with that chick yet?
Whereupon I encountered for the first and only time a truly speechless Augustus Waters.
I,
he started, Hazel, well,
this boy appears to have some kind of developmental delay, Peter Van Houten said to Lidovai.
Peter,
she scolded.
Well,
Peter Van Houten said, extending his hand to me.
It is at any rate a pleasure to meet such ontologically improbable creatures.
I shook his swollen hand, and then he shook hands with Augustus. I was wondering what ontologically meant. Regardless, I liked it. Augustus and I were together in the Improbable Creatures Club, us and duck-billed platypuses. Of course, I had hoped that Peter Van Houten would be sane, but the world is not a wish-granting factory. The important thing was that the door was open, and I was crossing the threshold to learn what happens after the end of an imperial affliction. That was enough. We followed him and Lidovai inside, past a huge oak dining room table with only two chairs, into a creepily sterile living room. It looked like a museum, except there was no art on the empty white walls. Aside from one couch and one lounge chair, both a mix of steel and black leather, the room seemed empty. Then I noticed two large black garbage bags, full and twist-tied, behind the couch. Trash? I mumbled to Augustus, soft enough that I thought no one else would hear.
Fan mail,
Van Houten answered as he sat down in the lounge chair.
18 years worth of it. Can't open it. Terrifying. Yours are the first missives to which I have replied, and look where that got me. I frankly find the reality of readers wholly unappetizing.
That explained why he'd never replied to my letters. He'd never read them. I wondered why he kept them at all, let alone in an otherwise empty formal living room. Van Houten kicked his feet up onto the ottoman and crossed his slippers. He motioned toward the couch. Augustus and I sat down next to each other, but not too next.
"Would you care for some breakfast?"
asked Lidovai. I started to say that we'd already eaten when Peter interrupted.
"It is far too early for breakfast, Lidovai."
"Well, they are from America, Peter, so it is past noon in their bodies."
"Then it's too late for breakfast," he said. "However, it being afternoon in the body and whatnot, we should enjoy a cocktail. Do you drink scotch?" he asked me.
No, I'm fine, I said.
Augustus Waters? Van Houten asked.
nodding toward Gus. I'm good. Just me, then, Lidovai. Scotch and water, please.
Peter turned his attention to Gus, asking, you know how